Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
We're in depth on the taxes Trump would cut, the trade he would end, the jobs he would create. Mr. Trump's economic renewal plan promises robust factory operations, lighter tax burdens on American families and companies, and the creation of millions of jobs. Today, a discussion on the dollars. What does it cost to cut taxes like that? Where's the market demand that would prompt companies to bring on more workers? And is the economy in as much disrepair as Donald Trump says it is?
For every 1% of GDP growth we fail to generate in any given year, we also fail to create over 1 million jobs. What a waste, and what a sad, sad thing. America's job creation deficit, due to slower growth since 2002, is well over 20 million jobs. And that's just about the number of jobs our country needs right now to put America back to work at decent wages.
Two guests, your perspective on the economy from your household. If you've identified one economic factor in your family budget that makes you anxious, that you'd like to see addressed, what would it be? Is it a salary that hasn't risen in a while? Is it taxes that seem too high? Where does your own economy meet the plans, the economic plans, from the candidates? Think about that. Join our discussion, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Again, I want you to frame this perhaps in this way, where the economic factors in your own household budget, where they create anxiety for you. Is it the fact that you haven't had a raise in a while, that you pay taxes that you think are too high? Where does your economy meet the plans of the candidate? Doug Holtz-Aiken is one of our guests. He's an economist, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, former economic advisor to the McCain presidential campaign, and he's with us from Washington. Doug, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Jillian White is with us. She's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she writes about economic politics, and she wrote a recent article called Trump's Economy, Lower Taxes, No TPP, and Affordable Child Care. And she's with us from Washington. And Jillian, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Doug, I guess I would come back to you. We heard how Donald Trump frames what's happening in the economy today. Is it in the kind of disrepair that he talks about?
I think the looking back and saying there's 20 million missing jobs is too strong. I think the issue of better economic growth is actually central. From the end of World War II to 2007, the U.S. economy grew fast enough that the standard of living doubled roughly every 35 years. So you can imagine in one working career, the standard of living doubling, and that was how we met everyone's version of the American dream, whatever that was for you, a house, going to college, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. The CBO and the Fed now peg the long-run growth potential of the U.S. economy at 2%, which means the standard of living will double every 75 years. And so I think there's a genuine concern about the ability of the U.S. economy over the long term to deliver the sustained increases in well-being that people are used to and expect. And that is something worth addressing.
Jillian, do the numbers that Donald Trump talks about apply in the way that Doug Holtz-Aiken suggests, that the greatest issue that we have to address is this slowdown of increased quality of life and income increases?
Yeah, I absolutely think that the issue of growth is something that needs to be addressed and probably one of the biggest problems facing the country going forward. I think that part of the issue with the speech is that some of the ways that the numbers were used kind of takes things out of context or mischaracterizes, what the causes of some of the slowdown were. For instance, to say that a lot of the issues with economic growth were born just in the last 7 or 8 years is misleading. That is not true. Some of the growth issues that we've had, some of the issues of a declining economy have been true for, several administrations.
I want to understand what these new tax brackets that Trump has proposed really mean. And I thought this might be more explanatory if we created some hypothetical American family. So see if you two can address this way. So we've got the Joneses, family of four, making $60,000, Doug, one child in daycare. Can you tell whether the Jones family at that level of income with those kinds of financial obligations are going to pay fewer taxes under Trump's plan?
Honestly, I don't know.
Because of my hypothetical or because the plan isn't clear?
No, because of Mr. Trump.
Okay.
I mean, this is what we know, and this is quite frustrating to me. He had a plan, and it had some very sharp rate reductions, and it had took a lot of people off the rolls and had a bunch of provisions. And then he went out and gave a speech and said, you know, I'm going to embrace what the House Republicans have done for their rates. So the rates are going to be 12, 25, and 33, which are a bit higher than the ones he had originally proposed. He said, I'm also going to, you know, do some other things that are similar to what they like, and I'm going to have this deduction for child care costs. And at that point, he took the old plan off his website. You can't find it anymore.
Right.
And we don't know what the new plan really is. We know there are these three rates that he's embraced. I don't know where they begin, where they end. The House Republicans have a plan, but he hasn't said he's taken the whole House Republican plan. So it's a very frustrating situation if you care a lot about sort of tax policy and the budget, because his original plan blew a huge hole in the budget. Now we don't know where we are.
Okay, so Jillian, I thought it was me that I could not figure out where these brackets land in income. I'm really glad to hear that you're both confused too. Go ahead.
There isn't a ton of clarity there, and I think that's part of the reason people felt so frustrated with this speech. It's that, you know, we are only a few months out from the election at this point, and what we would expect to see when a candidate makes a major speech, or what we would hope to see, is some clarity, some more concrete understanding of what exactly their plan is and how exactly it would work. And as my guess said, or it just doesn't seem to do that. I think part of the problem is that we don't know where these tax brackets begin and where they end, and we cannot actually put numbers to it in terms of how much damage it would do to the actual overall budget.
So can either of you tell if you're wealthy, are you going to pay lower taxes? Because in one breath, he says the rich are going to pay more, but there also seem to be some tax cuts in there for wealthy Americans. Again, I guess it's hard to tell with where the brackets are. Doug, do you know?
It is his promise that everyone will pay less taxes. So there's no question the rich will pay lower taxes. The statements about the rich paying more have come at various points in the campaign, and they're quite confusing. Sometimes he says it's more than I originally said, which means I'm still giving him a cut. It's just smaller. That would be the case if he took the House plan. But it's a characteristic of the Trump campaign to hold two policy proposals simultaneously that are in conflict, and it doesn't seem to bother him.
Sorry to laugh at that, but that is true. So, Jillian, I heard one of Trump's main economic advisors on Morning Edition this morning, and he was saying we're going to cap deductions. We're going to, so no matter where you are, at a certain level on the income scale, you are going to be allowed to take $75,000 or somewhere on that range of deductions, but that's it. And we're going to eliminate a lot of the other deductions. Do you have any other clarity? I mean, is he talking about eliminating the mortgage deduction? How do you understand this part of the plan?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of what I think is so confusing. During the speech, he repeatedly promised over and over that there would be more clarity, that there would be more detail in the days to come. And I don't know if anyone else has seen it. I certainly have not. So it's not 100% clear where those deductions are ending, what is getting left behind and what isn't. You know, I think one of the things that he was clearest about was that he was going to change the tax brackets and make them a little closer to what House Republicans had put forth, and that he was going to end the estate tax. And, you know, you asked before if the wealthy were going to be paying their fair share, were they also going to be getting a tax cut? And
yeah,
there are just several ways in the plan that he's laid out, as vague as it is, where it seems like, yeah, the wealthy are absolutely getting a pretty significant tax cut. And he really hammered home the end of what he called the death tax or the estate tax. And that is something that primarily will help wealthy households.
I was going to say, I mean, the people that are, isn't the cap on that at $11 million below that, you don't have to pay estate taxes? I mean, the people that affects are a tiny percentage of American taxpayers, aren't they?
Yeah, it is a pretty small percentage. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities at one point had said that the estates that fall into this, you know, are within the top 0.2%. So that would be a pretty tiny number.
Yeah. Okay, Doug, let me try this then to try to get some clarity, since I feel like all I'm doing is adding to the confusion, which is not what the show is about. Is it a matter of accepted economic policy that we should allow fewer deductions because that would give us a more robust should we just allow, I don't even know how to put that. Is it a matter of economic policy that we should allow fewer deductions?
So the basic premise of tax reform is lower rates and broaden the base, which is get rid of special deductions and loopholes and exemptions. And the reason economists like that is it means that people are deciding how to live their lives based on what they value, okay, not based on what the tax code rewards. And so a going-in premise of any effort at tax reform is the idea that taxes should not interfere with decisions that households are going to make about, you know, how big a house they should buy, how much health insurance they should have, you know, what kind of college education. Let's try to, you know, minimize the sort of gaming of those things. And over on the business side, do the same thing. We don't want to have businesses running their businesses for tax purposes. We want them to hire people, make good products, and sell them to Americans so they live well. And that's the idea behind tax reform.
And is the reason, Jillian, that though some of those deductions have not been eliminated because Americans hold on pretty tight to things like mortgage deductions?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the tax code has been one of the more contentious political points, not just in this election, but in elections past, because it is the thing that a lot of Americans have used to figure out how to run their businesses and how to manage their finances. You know, who can best game the tax code so that they're paying the least in taxes and able to get the most credits and the most deductions and hold on to most of their wealth. So I think if you've been doing pretty well in that system, the last thing you want is for that system to change.
Right. Conversation this morning, and I was going to say to try to add some clarity to the economic plan that we heard from Donald Trump in Detroit. I don't know if I'm accomplishing that. We're saying that there's a lot of holes in the plan. We're not sure how the money works, but we're giving you, I guess, the broad outline here of what Donald Trump has been talking about. Hillary Clinton gives her speech today, also in Michigan, and we will talk about the specifics of that at the beginning of next week. But as you tune into the conversation, I'm curious about if there's an economic factor in your own household budget, in your own economic life, that you'd like to see addressed with these plans from these candidates. I mean, is it this idea that you've been making an income that hasn't gone up very quickly, that you feel like you're paying too many taxes, that there is a deduction that you really don't want the candidates to eliminate? Where does your own economy meet the plans from these candidates? 651-227-6000. By the way, we're also going to talk about trade if you're interested in that. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at CarrieMPR, where Mark says net new private sector jobs under Obama, 10.6 million. Under the last two Republican presidents, 12 years, 1.1 million. Net new jobs, 15 times better under Obama. Does he have his math right, Doug?
I can check the numbers, but I think the key thing to recognize is a lot of that is recovery from the deepest recession since the Great Depression. One would certainly hope we'd get those jobs back. I think the major critiques of the record have been the pace at which those jobs came back from the Great Recession is a relatively slow recovery. But more importantly, for those people who had a job, and that's the vast majority of people, there really has not been significant increase in their wages, especially adjusted for inflation, until the most recent couple of quarters. So it's been a long slog with no increase in real incomes for most Americans.
And Jillian, Mark also says on Twitter, listening to Trump's speech, I heard a lot of things the right for years has been accusing the left of wanting to do, not your old GOP. Was that your feeling about that as well?
I mean, I think this has been a frustration for a lot of folks on the right about the way that Trump is campaigning, that they're hearing a lot of things that they feel like aren't necessarily 100% in line. I don't know that they're, you know, necessarily as far as going to Democratic principles, but yeah, I think a lot of it maybe doesn't sound like the old GOP, but we're not, you know, part of the problem we're having this morning is it's kind of hard to place it.
Yeah. Well, and that's what the whole campaign has been about. I guess we could expect. Yeah, Doug?
I think it's actually, you know, one way to think about the what's going on is that Donald Trump is not campaigning like a Republican. In fact, many think he's not a Republican. He's campaigning the way Democrats typically campaign, which is identify some constituencies, say they're blue collar workers, and for them, tell them I'm opposed to trade agreements, I'm against immigration. That'll appeal to them. Now let's go find those disgruntled establishment Republicans and tell them we like the House Republican tax plan. Now let's go find every Republican and attack Hillary Clinton. And so the speech, if you look at it, is put together much like many of Hillary Clinton's speeches would be put together to target constituencies with particular policies. It drives Democrats crazy because it's really taking their playbook and stealing it, and it drives Republicans over the edge because they just don't understand this at all.
To the phones to Lyle in South Minneapolis. Hey, Lyle, how are you thinking about this?
Well, I can tell you trade is the number one issue. I've been in the white-collar world and the gray-collar world and blue-collar world over 35 years. I'm almost 60 years old, and I've seen the wages just flat, and that really started when after Reagan was president, and we can blame Clinton and the Congress, probably the Congress more than anybody else, because these free trades have just flattened us out. We can't have any more of these so-called free trades like TPP. But the biggest item in every family's budget, and I'm a single father with four children, is health insurance, a single-payer health insurance. That should be the number one item next to TPP or changing these free trade deals so that real wages could come up,
okay,
so that our real expenses can go down and hopefully have a better economy within the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and let Asia do what Asia wants to do within the Asian world.
Okay. So Lyle, let me pick up on a few of the things that you said. Doug and Jillian, Trump is saying that manufacturing jobs have been cut by one-third since 1997, and he blames NAFTA and China's presence in the World Trade Organization. Jillian, can you draw a direct line between those loss of manufacturing jobs and the reasons he cites?
You know, I think this is kind of a simplistic argument on Trump's part. And when he comes up with solutions, I guess I feel like they're a little bit backward looking, right? So his solution isn't necessarily to change trade or change the way we manufacture in the U.S. In a way that's forward looking. It's to cut out both of these agreements and try and harken back to something that we were doing in generations past. And I don't know that that works either.
I mean, Doug, one of the things you hear Donald Trump say is that he is going to force companies to, or he's going to fine, I guess, companies if they will not build factories in the United States to force them to stop building overseas and using overseas labor. Can he do that? How would that change our trade profile with other countries?
No. I think, you know, this is one of the most misleading aspects of the things he talks about. Anyone who has looked seriously at the employment patterns in manufacturing and what's going on in the U.S. recognizes that while employment is down in manufacturing, unquestionably, the amount of production in manufacturing is way up. And what that turns into mechanically is higher productivity. We've had enormous productivity growth in manufacturing. And if you want to pick something that's the cause of loss of manufacturing jobs, it's going to be the productivity far more than the trade. And in terms of the ability of firms to locate, you know, firms can, in fact, leave the United States. They can headquarter themselves in any country around the world, build factories, and hire people. The question is, what would make a company want to be in the United States, hire in the United States, and expand in the United States? And those are the kinds of things that should be focused on.
I don't want myself to miss this, and I don't want our listeners to miss what you just said about the loss of manufacturing jobs. The primary reason, as you see it, is because companies got more efficient. Manufacturing lines got more efficient. They simply didn't need as many people as they did in these halcyon days that Donald Trump talks about in the, 50s and 60s.
Right. It's not that we're not producing things. We are. It's that we're not employing as many people to do it. So our manufacturers are, quite frankly, the efficiency envy of the world. We have the most efficient manufacturing sector, the most advanced manufacturing goods. They are filled with advanced technologies, and that's why they are so successful, in fact, in competing on the world stage. So to blame trade, I think, is to really scapegoat the issue when something more fundamental in the economy is going on.
I want you both to listen to something that Congresswoman Debbie Dingell said this morning on Morning Edition. She kind of raised some of the issues that we're talking about here around trade and these questions. But she also said that the message that Trump brings into her state and places like Michigan really resonates. And here's why.
He talks about trade, and trade and lost jobs resonates in a state like Michigan. I have constituents who, if you don't dig deeper with them, are supporting Trump.
So these are constituents, Jillian, that say get rid of TPP, perhaps without really realizing what that would mean for their own life and their own economics. Would it make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue, as Douglas just said, is that people kind of see these trade agreements and think all of these jobs have been shipped out overseas and that is the problem. And if we get rid of trade, all of these jobs will come back. And that's just simply not true, which is part of the issue with Trump's speech that I was bringing up earlier. You know, we can talk about harkening back to the old days with manufacturing and the booms that happened there and all of the jobs that were plentiful in states like Michigan. If we cut out trade, that doesn't mean that those sectors in those states will automatically surge, because productivity and efficiency of these companies and of manufacturers has increased. So what we need to be doing is looking at a way forward, not looking to the past for solutions that won't work now.
I guess, Doug, I also want to ask that if he's going to open up some of these trade deals, as he says, with Mexico and China, the United States isn't necessarily going to get what it has now, right? Aren't there some pitfalls potentially for the U.S. in opening these deals?
Enormous pitfalls. I mean, one hates it when you sign a contract with somebody and then they completely ignore it and renege. And Canada is going to dislike this being reopened. If we put 45% tariffs on Chinese goods, you can bet they'll put tariffs on our goods. And there's a real concern among world economic leaders that a Trump presidency could trigger trade wars of the type that preceded the Great Depression. And, you know, his notion that he can cut a better deal ignores the fact that there are going to be presidents 10, 20, and 30 years down the line who are going to have to deal with the fact that the U.S. would be perceived as an unreliable partner that does not honor deals that are cut.
Doug Holtz-Aiken is one of our guests this morning. Jillian White, the other, she's from The Atlantic. He is president of the American Action Forum. And we asked them to join us this morning to interpret some of the ideas behind Donald Trump's economic plan unveiled in Detroit at the beginning of the week. Hillary Clinton is talking about hers today in Michigan as well, and we'll talk about it on Monday. But we're trying to be fair here, it's kind of a framework. A lot of the details have not been filled in. I guess we're talking about some of his larger themes that he discusses on the campaign trail and trying to figure out what that would mean for the economy of average Americans. To the phones, to Joe, listening in southern Minnesota. Joe, you wanted to say something about manufacturing. Is that right?
I did. I am an ex-tool and die maker. And when we talk manufacturing, you know, there's the process of assembling parts. But there's also the process of making those parts. And a lot of them are made in injection molds and metal stamping dies. And that is what we've lost in this country. Those are the high-skilled, high-tax-paying jobs. There's millions of hours in all of these, and it's labor-intensive. Sure, the computers have made it much, much easier and more efficient, but you still have to make these tools, and they're all being made in China now by very low-skilled labor. And that we've lost our tax base. We can't feed our economy anymore because we don't have the tax base anymore.
Doug, what would you say to Joe's argument there?
Well, I will first of all say I am not a tool and die expert, so I won't even pretend to be.
Okay.
There's no question that if you pick a trade issue that did have big impacts and that I believe was underestimated by everyone, it was the impact of China's entry into the world trading system. China and India represented billions of low-wage workers. It had an unmistakable global impact on pay scales in every country, including the U.S., and I don't think it was well anticipated, and I don't think policymakers in the U.S. Were prepared to deal with it very well. The only shred of good news in that story is it's over. It's happened. There is no comparable possible event out there in the future. We just don't have countries like China that could enter the trading system. And now the issue becomes, how do you look forward and how do you construct your trade agreement, certainly, but also how are you going to train people, educate them, have them be ready to compete in this global world? And I think one of the things that concerned me about the Trump speech is he talked a lot about how he was the leader for the 21st century, but he hearkened entirely to an economy of 1965, where it was all steel and buildings. And he didn't once mention the internet. He didn't mention innovation or entrepreneurism. There's no Uber. There's no Etsy. There's nothing like that in his vision of the world. And that's not the world we live in.
I have to say, though, Jillian, as I was reading ahead to prepare to listen to Hillary Clinton's speech today, I see, you know, worker retrain. I see the usual kind of suggestions for this, but none of the, and maybe she's going to get into more detail today, but none of the kind of detail that the three of us are looking for. Do you?
I haven't seen it either. You know, that would be the hope, as I said, that people are, you know, now filling in and giving us a little bit more meat about exactly what it is that they're doing. But, you know, I think a large portion of Trump's speech was spent refuting you know, the policy points that Hillary has made in the past and things that have happened under the Obama administration, and then kind of just providing a loose framework for what he thought were changes in his plan and what he thought that his base wanted to hear. So, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if we got something similar today.
Right. Yeah. Justin says on Twitter, Trump, Clinton are perpetuating the myth that a president can micromanage the world's largest economy. It's arrogant and false. Doug, is that right?
I think that's right. And it is a mistake always to try to run the economy from Washington, especially from the West Wing of the White House. There are 310 million Americans out there who are trying to arrange their lives to live as well as they can, and you can't possibly anticipate what they'll do and what they'll want. And so, you know, setting up basic rules of the road, enforcing laws effectively, and then letting them figure it out has always been a good rule of thumb, and is what has made the United States the most prosperous country on the globe. It's really quite remarkable what it has accomplished.
I want to come back one more time here before we go to the phones to this, because Donald Trump told an anecdote a few days ago about imagining a day when he's president and the head of a car auto manufacturing company calls him to say that they are building the next automotive assembly plant in the United States. And he says that they are doing that. They're making that call because they don't want to be subject to these fines. To be clear here, he talks about this a lot. Can a president, I mean, is there any kind of mechanism that you can see that a president would be able to force an American company to build here and not there? Either of you? No.
I can't imagine this. I mean, okay. You know, this is not within his powers. A Congress could pass a law that put particular taxes or tariffs on the sale of products in the U.S. by a headquartered company that are manufactured outside the U.S. We've never done that. And I'd be shocked if it went through a Congress, but the president can't simply do it.
Right. Jillian, the only thing I can think of that even compares to this is trying to stop American companies from merging with those companies overseas and calling that their headquarters so they can dodge American taxes. I mean,
right.
President Obama addressed that.
Right. Inversions are a big thing right now. And, you know, Trump brought that up, too, saying that he would, you know, create a system where that wouldn't be allowed anymore and that we would get tons of money back from these inversions. Again, not a huge amount of clarity there on how that would happen. But to your point about can he, you know, force companies to do business here? Not in any way that I see either. I think the entire idea is to create incentives to make companies want to be here. I think that's a lot different than forcing them.
Okay. To the phones.
Doug. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
On that point, I think one of the most, there are two things that I think have become very clear. The first is if you talk to a foreign headquarter company that has big operations in the U.S., like a Siemens or something, mm-hmm. what they will say is the U.S. needs more skilled workers of the type who are skilled tradesmen. They're not looking for PhDs. They're looking for people who can run a welding shop, who can actually do the kind of skilled trades that have been missing in the U.S. for quite a while. So that's a piece of the educational aspect that I think is worth looking at and could be done relatively quickly. And then over the longer run, the shocking number is that if we raised U.S. educational attainment to the level of the Canadians, just, you know, they're practically like us, we ought to be able to do it, wages would be $2 trillion higher than they are right now.
Wow.
And the single most important thing we could do is have better education from K through 12. And you don't hear enough talk about that.
So are you saying, Doug, that Canadians graduate much more ready to meet the demands of their economy than our graduates do?
Yes. Far too many U.S., you know, kindergarten through 12th grade students don't graduate. Those who do graduate are not prepared for college and are not prepared to compete. And the Canadian educational attainment is far better.
Jillian, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, I think those are fascinating statistics.
Wow, I know. $2 trillion.
There's nothing else that compares to that. That's the most powerful thing we could do.
Wow. To the phones to Pat in Big Lake. Hey, Pat, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
I have actually two comments, one that I started the phone call with and one that I'd like to add. My husband and I are in our late 50s. Our income has not gone anywhere in the last 10 years at least. He is in the service industry or a trade industry, mm-hmm. and it's completely stagnant. Yet our health care costs have risen by over 25%. I also find this continual, you know, promoting people to get trade jobs and how good they are to be kind of bogus, because in the long run, an executive can work until he's 70 without a problem. Somebody working in the trades has a difficult time making it to 65, let alone 67.
Okay.
I think there are some real issues here that people aren't looking at because they have no experience with what's happening in those industries.
Doug, let me come back to you, given what you just said about vocational and trade jobs and the necessity for more people that are trained for them. Factor in what Pat just said to that.
I think Pat's exactly right. We know that, for example, you can make $100,000 in some cases in those jobs, but you are not going to have the longevity. They're far more physically demanding. And when we think about the social safety net, the Medicare, the Social Securities, you have to have a recognition of those things. And so when this shows up, it's usually the concern that raising the retirement age will disproportionately harm people who need to be in those industries for longer periods of time. But I think that I'd like to go back to the first point you raised. You know, the issue about income not rising is real. Mm-hmm. It shows up everywhere and in the data, and people are quite frustrated with it. And the issue with healthcare costs continuing to rise is also real. And one of the reasons people don't get a cash raise is they're often having any increase in their compensation go into covering healthcare costs. And it is a frustration of many that, you know, after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Part one was supposed to cover a lot more people, but part two, it was supposed to stop this growth in healthcare costs, and it just hasn't happened.
So I thought that the ACA was supposed to slow down the premium increases, not necessarily reverse them, but slow them down. I didn't think the ACA really addressed the cost of healthcare itself. You expected that.
It was part of the promise. I'll be honest, I don't think it was ever going to work, and it didn't. But, you know, the premium increases in the end reflect the underlying cost of care.
Yeah. Right?
You know, we see doctors, we get pharmaceuticals, we, you know, have all sorts of care, and then insurance pays that bill. And if the bill's getting bigger, the premiums are going to go up one way or another.
Yeah, Jillian, we did so many shows on the ACA. I think to a guest, they said, I don't see anything in the Affordable Care Act that is actually going to significantly slow down health care costs. And so people like Pat are continuing to see their premiums rise.
Yeah, I mean, I think that has definitely been one of the growing pains of the ACA. And I think everything or a lot of these issues harkens back to the pain of the fact that people do not have more money now than they had, you know, a decade ago,
right.
That their wages are not rising, that they are scared that social safety nets will not kick in for them. You know, there are lots of people who are scared that they won't have enough money to retire on, that they will not have enough money to support themselves, to pay for medical bills, to pay for housing. You know, and I think those fears are very real.
Mike says on Twitter, wages need to rise. Workers can't support the economy without discretionary spending. And to the phones to Steve. Oh, okay. And here's another Another observation here from Twitter. One reason that factories are not built in the U.S. is overregulation that drives up costs to build and run. Our corporate tax rate is too high. I wanted to get to this corporate tax rate because he is lowering it to 15%. Isn't there bipartisan agreement, Jillian, on Capitol Hill that the corporate tax rate does need to come down?
You know, I think there is agreement that the U.S. on paper has one of the highest corporate tax rates. But I also think that there's been a lot of discussion about the fact that very few corporations actually pay that tax rate and that the effective tax rate is significantly lower. So I think when we're talking about chopping the corporate tax rate down to 15%, we have to look at where we're really starting and then also how much revenue that would actually cut and where that would be made up.
Yeah. So, Doug, what kind of a difference would it make? And then does it blow a big hole in the budget?
So I think this is one of the most important tax issues facing the U.S. The U.S. does have the highest statutory rate. It also has very high effective rates if you do international comparisons. And it continues to try to tax the worldwide earnings of every U.S. headquartered firm. Every other country that we compete with has moved to a system where they only tax firms on the basis of what they earn in their country. So if we're a U.S. firm competing with a German firm in Brazil, the German firm pays the Brazilian tax and is done. The U.S. firm pays the Brazilian tax, but then has to pay a second layer of tax up to the highest rate in the world when it brings the money back. And that's the issue that drives inversions,
right?
Because if you move the headquarters to Germany, you no longer owe the second layer of tax. That's the issue that causes things to get located offshore. And lowering the rates to something that looks like 20 or even 15% would get us back into the middle of the pack, not at the bottom of the international competition. And I think knowing that the good jobs, the ones that have benefits and things, have been located in those kinds of globally competitive firms, this becomes an imperative for making sure that our workers are competitive.
So when Jillian says that not a lot of companies end up paying that rate, and you say even the effective rate is kind of high, you're saying,
yes,
even though a lot of companies can dodge the statutory rate, they still end up spending more on taxes than a lot of countries in the world.
Yes.
Is
and
that
they
right?
have, unfortunately, a real incentive to the one way they can avoid paying the high statutory rate is to take their earnings and never bring them back to the U.S.,
yeah,
park them offshore, and as a result, they don't get plowed back into our economy. And that's, you know, just very perverse incentives if you want to have people hired in the U.S. and factories expanded in the U.S.
Jillian, what would you say about that?
I mean, I would say that even if the effective tax rate is a little higher, I think that cutting it significantly to 15%, like I said, I just don't see the math working out there, and I would want more details about how we're going to then make up that revenue.
Yeah, how much revenue is it?
We'll lose revenue, but remember, the corporation income tax raises about $300 billion. It's not anywhere close to the personal income tax, which is about $800, or Social Security taxes, which are another $800, and it's no longer a major source of revenue in the U.S. So We've reached the position where we have a very anti-competitive tax code that raises no revenue, and I do think there will be movement on Capitol Hill, both sides of the aisle, to do something about this.
So $300 billion, Jillian, fairly easily made up or not?
I mean, I think within Trump's plan, is it fairly easily made up when we're cutting taxes on a personal level as well? Not necessarily, no.
I want to agree with that. I mean, Trump's plan doesn't add up at all. I mean, let's not be confused.
it's part of a comprehensive issue, right? Where if we're saying we're going to cut taxes in all of these places and we haven't seen any ways that revenue is going to grow significantly to cover them, then I don't feel comfortable with that.
And by the way, when Mr. Trump is asked about that, he says that growth, lots of politicians use this. Jillian's chuckling. But lots of politicians say that. He's not the only one that says, well, the growth will create more of the revenue. You just wait and see. I mean, is there any reason to think that's not?
No.
Okay.
Look, going back to my CBO days, I've heard this hundreds of times. And the sad arithmetic of tax cuts is they do not pay for themselves. And if you're going to cut taxes, you have to be prepared to cut spending someplace or it will never add up. Mr. Trump's promising to spend a lot more, and so it doesn't add up. Hillary Clinton at this point doesn't seem to add up, and they're inheriting $9 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years from this president. So the absence of any care for deficit and debt, I think, is one of the striking hallmarks of this campaign.
Okay, so the presidential debates are coming up in the fall in about a month and a half. If you two were on the journalist panel, Jillian, if you were on the panel, what's the key question you'd ask about the economy to both candidates?
I mean, I think one of the questions is, you know, if we are cutting, well, one of the things that I would want to know from Trump is if we're making all of these cuts, you know, where are we making it up? What are the programs that you're cutting? Where is the revenue going to come from? How are we going to figure this out? And then conversely, when we talk about trade deals, you know, what is your actual plan? What is your better alternative? How are you actually going to concretely make up these jobs?
Doug, how about you?
I want to echo the first. On both sides, I want to know how this is going to add up. You know, Mr. Trump's plan does not add up. It can't. He's cutting taxes and raising spending. Secretary Clinton is raising $1.3 trillion in additional taxes, but has promised to spend something that looks like about $3 trillion. And so I would ask her, why do you believe that we can have new entitlement programs of all sorts, whether it's pre-K or family leave or help with child care costs when we don't have a secure foundation for Medicare and Social Security? And then on the trade front and the immigration front, I would want to know exactly what they would do, in particular with those here illegally and the future of legal immigration that is different than what we have right now.
I really thank you both for trying to work your way through this with us. Nice job. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.